Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director here at the Lowy Institute, and it's my great pleasure to be introducing our speaker today, the Honourable Bill Shorten, MP, Leader of the Opposition. And Mr. Shorten's speech could not be timelier. On Monday, 147 heads of state and government will attend the opening of the 21st Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in Paris. And following this, representatives from all the parties to the framework will meet to negotiate an agreement that will hopefully take the world forward on climate change. We know that Paris was brutalised a few weeks ago. Now we hope it will become the locus of optimism and hope once more. Here in Australia, the debate on climate change policy has been a volatile public issue. I said in my Boyer lectures recently that a generation ago, Australia might have led the world in finding a permanent market solution to the problem of reducing emissions. It was the kind of thing Australia did well. Yet in the past decade, climate policy helped to destroy several prime ministers and opposition leaders and nearly broke our politics. One of the most discouraging aspects of this rancorous climate debate was the commonly expressed view that because Australia is only responsible for a small percentage of global emissions, we should wait for other countries to lead. And for a while, it seemed that public opinion reflected this view, but it's very interesting that that view is changing. Since 2006, we have asked a tracking question in our Lowy Institute poll that tests Australians' attitude to global warming and the steps they think Australia should take to deal with it. In 2006, there was the high watermark where 68% of Australians said that climate change was a serious pressing problem, and Australia should begin to take steps now, even if this involves significant costs. But over subsequent years, that number came down and down and down to a low point in 2012, when only 36% of Australians agreed with this statement. But since 2013, that trajectory has changed, and this year, the Lowy Institute poll recorded the third consecutive rise in Australians' concern about global warming, with 50% of Australians seeking action on global warming now, regardless of cost. This was the highest result since 2009. And just this week, we've gone back into the field to test Australians' views in the lead-up to Paris. And this new poll that we've put out this week reveals that 62% of Australians think the Turnbull government should strengthen its commitments to reduce emissions if that's what's needed to reach a global agreement. The point of saying all this is to identify that the temperature of the public debate in Australia on climate change has changed. And so it is a very good time indeed to hear from the Leader of the Opposition, Bill Shorten, on this issue. And I might say I'm also very pleased to welcome the Opposition's Deputy Leader and the Shadow Foreign Minister, Tanya Plibersek. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Shorten was elected to the House of Representatives in 2007 as the member for Maribyrnong in Victoria. Before his election to Parliament, Mr. Shorten was the National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union from 2001 to 2007. He's held a number of ministerial positions, including Parliamentary Secretary for Disability and Children's Services, during which time he introduced the NDIS, also Assistant Treasurer, Minister for Financial Services and Superannuation, and in Cabinet as the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. In October 2013, he was elected Leader of the Parliamentary Labor Party and Leader of the Opposition. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Bill Shorten to the stage. Welcome, Bill.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet, the people who've cared and maintained our national estate for 400 centuries, and I pay my respects to elders both past and present. I'd also like to acknowledge a great daughter of Sydney and Labor's Foreign Affairs spokesperson and my Deputy Leader, Tanya Plibersek. In fact, it was a few weeks ago that Tanya, myself, and our immigration spokesperson, Richard Marles, had the privilege of spending 4 days in three diverse Pacific nations. Beautiful places, home to people of wind and waves, who for centuries have lived in harmony, in fragile balance between land and sea. But paradise is drowning. Rising sea levels, king tides, and storm surges are eating away land, roads and seawalls. Brackish water creeping into the village well. Sewerage system unable to cope with the floodwaters, spreading disease. We're talking about a crisis unprecedented in human experience and massive, permanent displacement of people. I met with Prime Minister O'Neill from Papua New Guinea, President Leok from the Marshall Islands, and President Tong from Kiribati. They told us and they showed us the threat that climate change poses to the Pacific nations. For these island nations, climate change isn't a political argument or an economic dilemma. It's an existential threat, a matter of survival, a violation of basic human safety and basic human rights. The islands of the Pacific may be the first affected, but no country is immune. The problem of climate change isn't confined to a few nations or one ocean. The other day, I was talking to a senior fire officer charged with keeping Australians safe in summer. I asked him what he thought about climate change. I wrote down his answer. Longer summers, shorter winters, changes to the seasonal cycle. And mitigation is harder because of a contraction of the burning off season. He went on, things are worse now because of climate change. No doubt. Things are worse now. No doubt. Today, the energy trapped in our atmosphere by human-made global warming pollution is equivalent to exploding 400,000 of the atomic bombs dropped at Hiroshima each day, 365 days a year. 2015 is set to be the hottest year on record, the warmest temperatures since before the Ice Age, heat waves in Australia are now five times more likely due to global warming. Rising water temperatures guarantees more extreme weather events, bigger, harder downpours, and simultaneously longer, deeper droughts. The same extra heat that evaporates water from the ocean extracts moisture even more quickly from the soil. Higher temperatures mean crop-damaging pests and insects too. All of this forces food prices higher. As the Pope, amongst others, has said, the gravest effects of our attacks on the environment are suffered by the poorest. This is the cost of climate change, the roll call. Floods, bushfires, drought, salinity and soil damage, storm damage, bleaching coral on the Great Barrier Reef, massive damage to coastal property and infrastructure, species extinction, water shortages, rising sea levels and melting glaciers, climate refugees. Kiribati has purchased land in Fiji to be an ark to house its refugees. Every National Academy of Science in every major country confirms the problem and agrees on the solution. Australia can take benefit if we take action on climate change. Australia has a lot to lose if we do not. More extreme weather events, heightened instability in our region. There's $5.7 billion in tourism dollars from the reef, which are in jeopardy. 65,000 jobs along Queensland regional communities in jeopardy. Just a 1.1 metre rise in sea level would cause $226 billion in damage to coastal property and infrastructure. Let me decode a number like 226 billion. 250,000 homes, 1,800 bridges, 120 seaports, Sydney and Brisbane Airport, 5 power stations, 3 water treatment plants. And an increase in drought frequency will cost our economy $7.3 billion a year, shrinking growth in our economy by a full percentage point of GDP. Three quarters of the land Australia currently uses for viticulture could be unsuitable by 2050. And there are the deaths from heat waves, along with health spending on cardiac and respiratory conditions, which would increase. We can rebuild a flood-damaged city every 50 to 100 years. We can restore fire-ravaged towns every half a century. We cannot afford to do it every 10 years. Australia cannot afford climate change. We cannot absorb the cost of things continuing as they are. But no nation on earth can. This is not a price that we can make our children or our grandchildren pay. Now, this is not doomsaying or green propaganda. It's just reality. The global temperature is rising, and human activity is the contributor. The proof is irrefutable. The science of climate change, despite the hysteria and the attacks on the integrity of research, is robust and it's not new. In 1824, a French mathematician named Joseph Fourier discussed the idea of the Earth's atmosphere trapping heat. In 1861, an Anglo-Irishman, John Tyndall, analysed the heat-absorbing properties of greenhouse gases. The very term greenhouse effect and the remarkably accurate prediction of the relationship between CO2 levels and atmospheric temperatures originated in Sweden in 1896. And no area of scientific inquiry in the past 30 years has been more rigorously tested, scrutinised and peer-reviewed. So let us not pretend that we have an obligation to give equal weight, coverage or credence to the babble of the denialist militia. We don't need to believe in gravity. We know it exists. We don't need to believe that smoking causes cancer and heart disease. We understand the medical evidence. We don't need to believe that asbestos kills. We can see that it does. And because we know climate change is real, we all have an obligation to act. To ask, how can we give ourselves a chance of keeping the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees on pre-industrial levels? Noting that for the small island states in our Pacific region, even a rise of 1.5 degrees represents a serious threat. Now, of the 147 heads of state, the 190 countries gathering for COP21, 55 will have populations larger than Australia, but only 11 will have larger economies. We cannot escape our role or ignore our record. We are the 13th largest polluter in the world, with the highest emissions per capita in the OECD. And despite the Liberal government accounting chicanery, our domestic emissions are going up, not down. We cannot expect complete transparency and honesty from other nations unless we are prepared to be completely transparent and honest ourselves. Malcolm Turnbull leads a Liberal government that in the last 2 years has abolished a price on pollution, abandoned an emissions trading scheme, slashed the renewable energy target, cut funding to climate change adaptation programs in the Pacific, cut funding to carbon capture and storage, and tried repeatedly to abolish the widely respected institutions of the Climate Change Authority, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. Now Malcolm Turnbull is flying to Paris, but he's carrying Tony Abbott's climate sceptic baggage. Malcolm Turnbull may have won the vote in the Liberal Party room, but Tony Abbott has won the climate change policy debate in the Liberal Party. Australia goes to Paris Without a national energy efficiency scheme, without carbon budgets or targets for industries and coal-fired power stations. We go to Paris as the only nation that has gone backwards on climate action in the past 2 years. The Prime Minister will walk onto his plane with a pathetic target in one hand and an expensive joke of a climate policy in the other, with a policy that cannot and will not work. Under the delightfully misnamed direct action, it is taxpayers, not polluters, who pay to reduce pollution at a significant cost to the budget. The Australian Industry Group estimates that if the government's target was delivered solely through budget spending, it would cost between $100 billion and $250 billion in unadjusted terms. And Malcolm Turnbull knows this. Of course he knows it. No one has delivered a more incisive critique of direct action than the current Prime Minister who's keeping it. He labelled it an environmental fig leaf to deliver a determination to do nothing. Now, he had that courage to tell the truth when he was an insurgent backbencher with nothing to lose. Yet now, with that much vaunted power in his grasp and the evidence in the front of his eyes, he now cannot admit what he knows in his heart and head to be correct. And to my mind, this is actually far worse than scepticism. I get that there are some people who just can't work out the evidence. But what do we say about someone who has worked out the evidence and still refuses to act? This is the selling out of the future of the people of Australia to placate the unscientific right wing of the Liberal Party. The Prime Minister knows what he ought to do, but he doesn't have the courage to do it. So I challenge Mr. Turnbull, if you are not prepared to do what is right, at least tell the Australian people what the economic and environmental consequences of climate change really are. At least engage them in that conversation. At least lead the debate about the economic threats that climate change poses to all Australians. And I can promise him this. If he is prepared to do at least that, if he's prepared to be honest about climate change and its effects, he will get no political pushback from Labor. Australia needs stronger targets and better policy. Only Labor will cut pollution through the best available pathway and the most economically efficient way. Ours is the only policy that caps pollution. We have set a substantial renewable goal of 50% of our energy mix to be derived from renewable sources by 2030. We will transform our energy markets to cleaner, more efficient sources. It's only Labor who will build an internationally linked emissions trading scheme and a suite of energy efficiency and transition measures underpinned by a carbon reduction target. We will put a cap on pollution. We will create new opportunities for Australian firms to trade and engage with other emissions trading scheme jurisdictions, which are already 40% of the world's economy. When China's national scheme comes online, one in every three people in the world will live in a jurisdiction with an emissions trading scheme. Rejecting an emissions trading scheme risks isolation from the global marketplace. As momentum accelerates across nations for action on climate change, it is only a matter of time before a lack of an authentic climate change policy will be an obstacle to trade deals. In fact, it's entirely possible The trade negotiations will mandate an effective price on carbon or face border tax adjustments. And Labor will secure the goal of decarbonising our economy while ensuring that the emissions-intensive trade-exposed sectors and agriculture remain globally competitive. We will consider every good idea, including targeted assistance for encouraging our advanced manufacturing sector to invest in productivity and skills, to pursue clean energy, to improve their processes and procurement, and to bring new products to new markets. We will improve our subpar national energy productivity, lifting standards in building and vehicle emissions and improving land use. All of these policies will be calibrated to meet Labor's long-term targets. Now, the first long-term objective Labor pledges itself to today is for Australia to achieve net zero pollution by 2050. Stopping global warming means stopping new pollution. If we're to meet the global target of 2 degrees, we must reach a point where we are not adding pollution to the atmosphere. This means by 2050, every tonne of pollution that we produce will need to be rebalanced by sequestering, offsetting, or purchasing. Well, this is an ambitious goal, a goal recognised by the Australian Climate Roundtable, which includes groups as diverse as the Australian Conservation Foundation, the Australian Industry Group, the ACTU, and the Business Council of Australia. And internationally, a goal recognised by global business leaders like Ratan Tata and Unilever's Paul Polman. Now, I'm very confident that the Paris Conference will mark a turning point towards the decarbonisation of the global economy with a new focus on net zero pollution. Achieving net zero by 2050 will demand major technical transitions in a range of industries. Now, these changes and adaptations are achievable. Indeed, they're necessary. Australia cannot rely on future growth fueled by higher emissions. To do so would be economically reckless. But it's only Labor who will get on with diversifying and decoupling our economy, separating emissions growth from economic growth. Because in a decarbonising world, our high emissions intensity, electricity, transport and export industries have clear business challenges. Changing technology, modernising fuels, embracing clean energy does not mean trading away our prosperity. In fact, it means the opposite. ClimateWorks modelling, based on net zero by 2050, forecasts that our economy will still be 150% larger than it is today. With the right plan and the right approach, Australia can lower emissions and lift economic growth. We can cut pollution and create jobs. Achieving net zero requires us to embrace the whole range of available technologies and methods. That's everything from switching transport, industry and buildings to biofuels, gas, carbon-free electricity, to reducing agricultural emissions through better land management, farm practices and increased carbon forestry. Now, we cannot foresee every technological advance that we will utilise between now and 2050. But any prediction that we make about the progress of technology will, in all likelihood, be an underestimate. Let me illustrate what I mean. In 1976, the cost of a solar cell was $79.40 a watt. Today, it's less than 70 cents. In the past 5 years, solar photovoltaic prices have fallen by about 75%. The cost of battery storage is halving every 18 months. Every 18 months. The story we see playing out across our economy, this is the story of the Australian economy. It's rapid evolution, not revolution. Transition, not upheaval. Australia's primary industries, including mining and agriculture, will remain strong and important parts of our economy. Our energy sector will gradually shift towards low pollution sources, but the process under Labor would be handled sensibly, steadily, and fairly. Now, as I've made clear, the Abbott-Turnbull 2030 target puts Australia at the back of the international pack. No amount of saying it reduces on a per capita amount is sufficient for the reasons I've already outlined. It certainly falls well short of Australia's obligation to help keeping warming below 2 degrees on pre-industrial levels. Now, Labor is far from alone in this view about the inadequacy of the existing Abbott-Turnbull target. Scientists say it's inadequate. Economists say it's in the increase will actually cause will increase the cost by delaying what we really need to do. Diplomats make it clear that it fails our international obligations. Business and investors say it creates uncertainty. The analysts have concluded that it would still leave Australia as the highest per capita polluter in the developed world. And I think if Malcolm Turnbull was still a backbencher, he would say the targets weren't good enough. Australians expected better of us, and Australia should aim to be better. When I became Labor leader, I took on board the Shadow Ministry for Science portfolio, and our climate policy was guided by the best science. That is why Labor established the Climate Change Authority to provide independent advice to the Parliament on important intergenerational decisions. The Climate Change Authority recommended a baseline emissions reduction of 45% by 2030 based upon 2005 levels. Today, I announce that Labor will use the Climate Change Authority's recommendation of a 45% reduction as the basis for our consultations with industry, with employers, with unions, with the community. And we'll undertake this process, mindful of the consequences for jobs, for regions, and for impacts upon households. Our target will work in concert with our 2050 objective and our strategies for managing transitions within particular sectors. The process begins today. Our Shadow Minister for Environment and Climate Change, Mark Butler, will lead this, reporting to myself and the Shadow Cabinet by the end of March next year. A 45% baseline reduction would be an ambitious target for Australia, particularly on a per capita basis. But of course, the very first line of the government's own modelling, undertaken this year by Warwick McKibben, states, the Australian economy is expected to grow strongly by 2000 towards 2030, regardless of whether Australia adopts a post-2020 target. The same modelling found that the economic impact of a 45% target would be minimal, and that Australia's economy would still, in real terms, grow by 23% over the decade with this target in place. And of course, this modelling took no account of the economic consequences of not adopting this sort of target. Then there's the CSIRO modelling. This suggests that the economic growth estimate is in fact extremely conservative and that jobs and investment will be far stronger. Now, in setting our long-term goals, we need milestones and measurements along the way. That is why Labor will support a pledge and review process every 5 years, helping Australia to track our commitments and to respond to international action. As business, the Climate Change Authority and others have stated, a combination of five-year targets and long-term goals balances the need for flexibility and accountability, while also giving business the long-term signals they need for certainty to plan and invest. Within the first year of a Labor government, guided by our 2030 and 2050 goals, we will announce an emissions reduction target for 2025, a target shaped by the best independent advice from policy experts, scientists and economists. This will explicitly consider how Australia does its fair share towards an international, bipartisan goal of avoiding 2-degree warming. Above all, delivering enduring economic and environmental reform depends and rests upon an informed discussion with the Australian people. Because the decision to take action on climate change has to be owned by empowered Australians. This is why Labor will take a thorough and principled approach to managing the economic transition that climate change demands. In a modern global economy, government cannot row every oar, but governments do have a responsibility to steer. 2, invest in research and science to drive new opportunities, to offer the right incentives and send the right signals, to provide certainty for business and investment. Climate change is most definitely upon us. We cannot wish this moment away. We cannot shrug our shoulders in the face of the responsibilities upon us. There is no security to be gained in stalling for time, regardless of the algebra of a coalition government and its right-wing rump. There's no benefit we obtain by deferring our decision to another day. The consequences of inaction, the dangers of delay, are far greater than the risk of failure. This is the truth. At a fundamental level, it's not just about our global responsibility, although there is a global duty that we owe. This is not about leadership in the Pacific, though there is a leadership role that we hold. It's a test of our national interest. Australians engaging with the jobs, trade and opportunity that action on climate change presents. It's about being an active player from the beginning, a home for new investment, a headquarter for new industries. The world will never wait for us. Never has. We have to step forward and seize the opportunity. This is the ambition that I have for Australia, and this is the vision that Labor will deliver after the next election. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shorten, for making a very strong speech containing a number of big, hairy targets. Mr. Shorten has agreed to take questions for about 25 minutes. I'm going to ask the first question, if I may, Bill. I noticed that senior government frontbencher Christopher Pyne has come out of the blocks this morning in anticipation of this speech, and he's described the targets that you've outlined today at the Institute as mad, and said you would have to introduce a carbon tax at twice the last rate and smash household budget costs at the cost of jobs and growth to achieve it. Can I invite you to respond?
It's like being flogged by a wet lettuce leaf, that attack. It's just not right. You know what madness is? Knowing what's happening and refusing to do something about it. Madness is when you know that the temperatures are rising, that CO2 pollution, greenhouse heat-trapping gases enfolding our planet, increasing the temperature of our planet. Madness is knowing the signs and refusing to act. Madness is knowing that a decision delayed is a cost increase. Madness is knowing that when you have your coastal property, and Australians, we're a coastal people, 90% of us plus live within 50 kilometres of the coast. We hug the coastline. If you know that you're going to have rising sea levels, it is madness to do nothing about it. Madness is actually pretending that for political purpose, you can ignore science. I think that when we look at what Christopher Pyne said, I'm sure that the old Malcolm would have been slapping on the palm of his hand on his forehead, listening to the madness of Christopher Pyne's attack.
All right. I'm going to call on people from the audience. Please wait until the microphone arrives and just tell us in a sentence your affiliation as well, if you have one at the beginning. Let me call on Anna Scarbeck to begin with.
Thank you. Anna Scarbeck, CEO of ClimateWorks Australia, whose research you cited. So obviously I share your confidence that this target can be achieved. I'm interested in hearing your reflections in what you've heard as you've brought your own team to this position. What has excited you about that pathway, and particularly what excites you about what we can achieve and the challenges that you think we can address in doing that?
It's all about leadership, isn't it? You set a direction and then you go for it. What excites me is a chance to break the conundrum or the toxic nature of the last 10 years where somehow science and climate change has become the victim of politics. What excites me is the idea that Australians can actually have the sort of leadership they deserve by a nation ambitiously setting targets for the future. Now, when we talk about net zero emissions by 2050, what excites me about that not only is what it means to accomplish it, what it means for new jobs, new investment, new industries, what it also says is we can get beyond the 24-hour cycle of politics and polls. What Australians want is direction. I borrowed a bit from Keating when he talked about the role of government is to steer, not row. The truth of the matter is government should be navigators. Australians are already organising their lives to deal with climate change. They already know it. I think climate change is one of those classic examples where traditionally, despite the best efforts, politicians have been behind the people. So what's exciting is to say to Australians, we have a view about the future, that we can actually master climate change, but we'll make decisions based on science, not the sort of crude babble of the tinfoil hat-wearing brigade who just want to deny everything. So I think that the real challenge is, if we're going to have leadership, it's not just to have these sort of metaphysical conversations after dinner about what are we going to do on anything. It's about having a plan and discussing the plan. I think the challenge for Malcolm Turnbull is he knows. He knows that their own policies are silly. I mean, going back to what Michael asked earlier, it's madness to put up a policy you know doesn't work. But, you know, he can't. He's done his deal with the devil. But in the meantime, Labor has the opportunity to lead on a climate change debate. And we really want to break that Gordian knot. I think we can. And that involves partly not relitigating the science, but talking to Australians about the consequences of climate change, the economic consequences. And we saw them first, Aunt Tanya and I and Richard, when we were in PNG. Drought. You see them when you fly over the Barrier Reef and the risk of ocean acidification and the bleaching of our coral. I understand how people earn their living in Cairns and Townsville. It's the interrelationship with the reef which generates so many jobs and tourism. It's exciting to think that we can help save their jobs. And when you visit these remarkable coral atolls of the Marshall Islands or Kiribati, when you land on a runway, which is the width of the island, when you see tens of thousands of people who don't have our money or our wealth working hard to deal with climate change, it's exciting that in Australia we can show that leadership and we can pursue our own interests. And what I do hope is that Malcolm Turnbull at least has the courage to talk about the consequences of climate change. See, we'll do Malcolm a favour here. If he's willing to work with me to talk about the consequences of climate change, I'm sure I can convince Australians about the merit of our policy. And then he would be doing a favour, at least by giving Australians the truth. Because if you understand the truth of climate change, you vote for real action, not for direct action.
Jenny Hayward-Jones from the Lowy Institute.
Thanks, Michael. Mr. Shorten, in your early stages of your address and just now, you mentioned your trip to the Pacific Island countries who are seriously affected by climate change. I was wondering what more Labor would do in government to assist the countries most seriously affected by climate change to adapt and mitigate those effects.
That's a good question. So were the first two, by the way. I think adaptation programs are important. I think the best thing we can do, and I'll get into the specifics in a moment, is the Pacific Islands don't view us as big brother in the Orwellian sense, and we should never view that relationship in that sense either with them. But when you look at the bigger countries of the Pacific, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea and ourselves, I think Australia has a role to be the brother which they want, which is to speak up for them. There's a million people across the Pacific, and who's going to speak for them if we do not? So I think that we must show leadership. They would rather I was talking about 1.5 Celsius, so let's be very clear. But they would, you know, they made it clear to me that if we talk about having policies which get us to at least restraining a 2 Celsius increase, they see that as at least some leadership. The Pacific Islands don't quite understand how Australia sees itself in the Pacific. You know, are we perched on the edge of the Pacific by geographical happenstance, but do we have a responsibility? I think we do. Then we get into how we help them with mitigation, how we train their young people, how we improve the movement of people between the Pacific and Australia. These are all policies which we can easily adopt in government, and Tanya is working very hard on them with our Parliamentary Secretary for the Pacific, Matt Thistlethwaite, and we'll have more to say about how we can specifically help in adaptation. but we do have a responsibility to the Pacific, not of paternalism, but of amity and proximity and shared values.
Next hand I saw was the woman in the front row.
Thank you. Hi, Gemma Najam from AAP. How will this climate action policy be funded?
Well, we're going to have Mark Butler out consulting about our 2030 targets. See, when we talk about funding a climate action policy, there's two questions before that. Should we have one, and what should it be? Should we have one? Yes, climate change is real. Secondly, is then we talk about what should it be? And we're proposing the parameters. Net zero emissions by 2050, and policies which aimed at restraining temperature increase within 2 Celsius. In terms of then the mechanisms, how we achieve that, we will not be having a carbon tax. What we will be doing is an emissions trading scheme, internationally linked. Perhaps the timing's a little more fortuitous. Perhaps there is a degree of the climate change wars could reach their end. I hope they could with a Liberal Prime Minister who, at least before he became Prime Minister, believed in climate change and effective action, and I'm sure he still does now. So what we need is a market-based system. We look for the most economically efficient system. In doing so, we understand that we have certain levers at our capacity. Emissions trading scheme, internationally linked. We have the push for renewable energy. We have the remarkable developments in renewable technology. We can also look at the rate of land clearance. We can look at vehicle emission standards, which was perhaps more problematic when we had a domestic car industry. We could look at building standards, which I think most people agree upon. So I think there are a range of mechanisms that we have to make it the minimum possible impact. But again, when you look at cost, please, as you record this for the media, remind people what the cost of not acting is. Remind them of the extreme weather events. Remind them of the increased cost of insurance. Remind them of the seawalls. If we stick with this government's policies, the industry to get into will be seawall building. Remind them of the missed opportunity of the $2.5 trillion worth of investment in renewables in the Asia-Pacific region by 2030. Remind them of the coral bleaching, of the ocean acidification. Remind them of the impact upon agriculture, from viticulture right through to crops. The increased likelihood of pests, there's a pretty big cost. So when we have a look at it, it's not just what are the programs and the mechanisms to implement it, it's what are the things you have to do to rectify the lack of action in the future. It's a no-brainer, people. Climate change and serious policies is the best economic prescription for Australia's future in the next generation and a half.
Oh, yes, the woman at the back.
Siobhan Fogarty from the ABC in Sydney. Mr Shorten, how would Labor cut emissions by 45% by 2030? Would it be solely through a carbon price, and how much would that need to be?
Well, chances are just... Good question. First of all, we haven't committed to that number yet. What we've said is that the best science has said that's what you've got to be aiming at, and believe me, that was the bottom of what the Climate Change Authority recommended. What I'm announcing today is three things. Net zero emissions by 2050. Policies which back in the science, which is trying to restrain global warming within 2 Celsius. And we will consult, led by my colleague Mark Butler, with industry, with employers, with households, with the community, with the experts, about mechanisms and how we would do 45% reduction. In terms of some of our likely mechanisms that we would consider using, vehicle emission standards, building standards, a much greater emphasis on renewable energy, an emissions trading scheme which is internationally linked. These are a range of some of the methods that we would use. And in terms of the cost, it's interesting. The Liberals or Tony Abbott's policy, because let's call it what it is, Tony Abbott's policy, 26 to 28% by 2030. Of the six mechanisms they propose, they haven't outlined four of them, how they would work. So I think that when it comes to detail, we're ahead of the game on the detail. We're prepared to consult. See, the truth of the matter is that when the Climate Change Authority made their report, the government should have proposed exactly what we're doing. You know, you get your best scientists, you ask them what should they do independently, and then you put it in the bin, or you put it in the drawer. Of course you do. Imagine if we had a Reserve Bank who had monetary policy, and they would say, oh, this is what they recommend on interest rates, and we just Oh, yeah, that's good. Put it in the bin and leave it for a year. We're doing the job the government was too lazy, too sceptical, or too just darn silly to do. You know, we're telling the truth. The truth is that the impact of climate change is a humongous cost. And I hope that when people report the job that we're doing, which is the job the government should have done, that they also report the costs of climate change. Extreme weather events, more extreme weather events, are covering more of the Earth's surface than before. The truth of the matter is there's more CO2, more carbon, more pollution in our atmosphere than there was previously. And if we don't do something about reducing the rate of emissions over time, then we are going to warm up this planet and we're going to make life hotter and harder and more inconsistent and more uncertain for people later. That's what we think the issues are.
Bill, can I ask you a question about the international dimensions of it? Before the Copenhagen conference, there were very high hopes that an agreement would be reached. And I know you're going to Paris, I believe, as an observer during the talks next week. How confident are you that the parties will reach an agreement, and if they do, that that agreement will be enough to get to the 2% we need to get to?
Second part's interesting. If you look at the proposals which have been made by nations around the world, so far they wouldn't actually get us to 2 Celsius degrees increase. It'd be still higher. The rate of increase would still be higher. But I'm pretty optimistic. I'm optimistic for a couple of reasons. President Xi Jinping of China and President Barack Obama of America have got on board. That's a big development from Copenhagen. Also, we are several years down the track and we see the consequences. Now, let's tell it straight here. You know, we've had the hottest years in the history of recorded temperature in the last 15 years. We've had 364 months in a row of the hottest monthly temperatures that we've had. Like, the problem isn't getting easier. It isn't going away. So I'm optimistic that, if you like, the science, the economic problems of climate change, and the change in mood of a range of world leaders gives this the basis for a much better launch pad to achieve a lot more than was achieved at Copenhagen. I just want Australia to be in there. Now, some people say, oh, Australia, we should leave it to someone else. What's the argument? We don't produce a lot of the overall carbon emissions, therefore it's not our problem. I'm trying to think how I would sort of explain that to the person in the street, and here I go. You wake up in the middle of the night. Your neighbour's house is on fire. Now, you could pull the doona over your head and say, I told him not to smoke. But when will that fire reach your house? It's as simple as that.
John Connor.
Thank you. Yeah, John Connor, CEO of the Climate Institute. Congratulations on far stronger and more credible targets. I think Copenhagen actually had one key success, which was the nomination of the 2 degrees goal, because it enabled us to do the maths and do carbon budget. And so we see radical hippies like the Governor of the Bank of England, financial institutions, World Bank, leaders even of the G7, recognising zero emissions is the mathematical consequence. It's not being anti-fossil fuel, it's pro-math. So my question is, with your reviews, will you make the carbon budget concept core to the reviews of the targets? And then coming to the implications here, one of the areas you didn't mention, one of the big challenges, is we do have coal-fired power plants with technology and hardware from the 1950s. We need to tackle the modernisation and replacement of those plants as part of core policy to achieve those goals.
Okay, well, let's perhaps go to the sort of the sizzle in the question, which is coal. We will be consulting on pollution reduction targets, which are underpinned by the best science, by a commitment to make sure that our industry still remains globally competitive, and the experts. The transition isn't going to happen overnight. When it comes to coal, it will still continue to play an important role in the world's energy mix for years to come. Coal isn't just about producing energy. I look at, from my background working in the steel industry, there's no substitute for metallurgical coal in steel production, for instance. Metallurgical coal accounts for, 58% of our exports for value? So I think that there's a role here for tackling carbon capture and storage. I think there's a role for utilising the technology advances in batteries. I'm a big fan of us affirmatively supporting investment in renewable energy. I think we should have an electricity modernisation plan which goes towards helping workforces. I also think that we can look at standards for emissions in future power stations. I think the market will answer quite a few of the concerns about the future over-reliance on coal, but I also want to make it really clear that we see that the tipping points come. I mean, the world is still demanding coal, but we'll reach a period of peak coal. We can't not. Also, what will happen, I believe, is that we see the tipping point in terms of the locus of investment moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And we've also put in place a target for Labor, if we're elected, a goal of 50% of our renewable energy. So we will create, by 2030, we'll create a market to incentivise renewable energy, but with those other remarks caveated along the way.
Thanks. Peter Hannam from Sydney Morning Herald. You referenced the Climate Change Authority a couple of times there, of course, maybe a few times, in fact. One of their recommendations was for Australia to ditch the carryover credits that probably make up the accounting chicanery, perhaps you were referring to a few minutes ago. Would you consider accepting that as part of your policy and come up with a 2020 goal as an interim between now and 2025 on the basis of those carryover credits going? And secondly, today the New South Wales Planning Assessment Commission approved an extension of a Rio Tinto mine in the Hunter Valley. And during your trip to the Pacific, I understand the leaders there were quite keen on a moratorium on new mines. At which point do you think it will be time to halt new mines, and how far off would that be?
Okay, Peter, there's plenty in that. I'm just going to make a note about a couple of them. We'll be consulting as part of our process on targets in terms of that point about the UN, but I think I've clearly indicated what my personal inclination is about that. And I should also say, whilst I don't unduly seek to butter up people, your writing about climate change has been marked by rigour. You've been holding the torch up in a very difficult period, so I'm grateful for the information you give Australians. So in terms of what we do by 2020, that'll be part of our consultations in the course of our lead up to March. In terms of the moratorium on new mines, and these leaders of these countries raised it with us, I indicated that we've got a bit more optimism that the market's actually answering that question rather than legislation in terms of moratoriums. We are looking at how we would have standards for power stations. There will be still some demand for coal. And when you look at some of the third world energy sources, basic wood, dung, other waste, you know, I'm not sure that they are more efficient sources of energy and emissions. But in the medium term, I think companies are going to start voting with their feet about not wanting to keep reinvesting in areas of energy and development which aren't going to deliver the longer term returns. But it is important we let the market work some of these issues through. I can't understand for the life of me why the Malcolm's Liberals are so reluctant to have an emissions trading scheme. It just is the most efficient allocator, especially if it's internationally linked.
I might ask the last question, if I may, Bill, even though you were nicer to Peter about his question than you were to me about mine. So I'll have another go.
I said at the very start after the third question, the first two were too, sorry.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you, just get off climate if I may, and ask you about Paris, where you're going next week. And obviously 2 weeks ago today, Paris was the site of this atrocity. So can I ask you, given that you're going to Paris, to reflect on 2 weeks on your thoughts on the Islamic State attack in Paris and the appropriate response of countries like Australia to that kind of attack?
Was dreadful, and I think a lot of people will remember a bit of where they were when they heard this news. It's one of those events which, sadly, is quite impactful. If not for the least, not only just the empathy for other people just enjoying themselves being gunned down, but we could all... Many people have been to Paris. You know, there's a certain randomness of the terror which is very human. It makes us, it's all a little more aware of our security. And that, of course, is the purpose of the terror. I think that the federal government, as supported by ourselves, have had the right reaction. I don't support a large Western expeditionary force into Syria. I think the history of those efforts have proven to be marked by failure, absolutely. I do think that we need to work a lot more in our own communities to make sure people are feeling included, and that's not soft. You know, some people, you're getting some conservative commentators to say that talk of inclusion and diversity is soft. It's not. It's actually a very hard strategy. Not only is it sort of morally right, I believe, but it's also, I think, the soundest strategy. In my conversations with security and police experts, I think they slap themselves on the head when they hear politicians saying, you know, blaming the Muslim menace. You know, that just shuts down communities. And let's also be really truthful. Terrorism has killed far more Muslims than Christians or atheists. So this idea that somehow it's some giant religious fault line and never can the twain meet, I completely reject. So, you know, I am supportive of our intervention in Iraq and the work of our Air Force, but I don't believe you're going to get a long-term peace until there's a regional solution, until there's genuine action taken on Assad as well. You know, I get that this is a really hard piece of machinery to sort of put into place. There's more moving parts than the Council of Vienna. But what I recognise is unless there's a regional solution owned by the people of that region, unless we understand the best way to defeat lunatics and crazies and psychopaths is by including people and stopping people spinning out to the margins. And I do have a fair degree of confidence in our authorities. And let's face it, the great gift of being an Australian is that we're a long way away from a lot of these troubles. So I think the world counts upon us to be sensible, not extreme.
Ladies and gentlemen, we like to finish events at the Institute right on time. So can I begin, first of all, by thanking you all for attending and for your insightful questions. And can I thank Mr. Shorten for joining us at the Lowy Institute today. We like it when leaders come to the Institute and give big, ambitious speeches, and he certainly delivered on that today. So thank you, Bill. Please join me in thanking Bill Shorten. Thanks very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll just give one out if I can. We have a few more events in the Lowy Institute event program for 2016. Our next event will be on the 7th of December. We'll have a lecture by the Chief of the Navy, Admiral Tim Barrett, and we hope to see many of you there. Thank you very much.